We're talking with Greg Pallast, investigative journalist with The Guardian newspaper and The Observer newspaper in Britain. And Greg is the author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, subtitled The Truth About Corporate Cons, Globalization, and High Finance Fraudsters. I'm Doug McNeil here in the studios of WHUS Radio.
And I'm George King from WHUS.
Greg, welcome to the show.
Glad to be with you, Doug and George.
All right. Greg, you've won a Project Censored Award, so that means you've been recognized for being ignored.
I've actually won, unfortunately, it's like an award you don't want, right? Unfortunately, I've won several Project Censored Awards. I think I'm going to get an award for winning the award. Project Censored, for those who don't know, is the California State University Journalism School's award for the most important stories of the year, which you can't read in the United States. So, as you can tell from my accent, I've been kind of exiled to England, where I report for the main papers there, the Observer, the Sunday paper, The Guardian, and BBC Television, which you, I don't know if you've ever heard of, but we do a couple broadcasts out of London. And
yes, I think I'm familiar with
it. Yeah, I'm familiar. We do more than upstairs, downstairs. We try to bring some news, and I do investigative reporting, which, you know, as you now know, is against, I believe it's the violation of Patriot Act 4 to do investigative reporting.
I'm afraid so, yes. So we're going to have to break off this call right here.
Yeah. So that's what I'm doing, is writing those reports that you can't otherwise catch in the U.S.
Now, as an investigative journalist, you're no stranger to controversy.
Nope.
And recently, it seemed like there was an article that you did which was trying to resolve a controversy, but it ended up creating another one. So that's my first question.
Yeah, good luck. See, no, you know how ungrateful people are when I try to end the controversy. It's the one time I'm usually trying to stir things up. Here I try to calm things down. What do you get? Go ahead.
You get a brouhaha.
Yeah, a brouhaha.
Well,
yes. But who's laughing? Go ahead.
I wanted to clarify something about a report you did on Alternet on June 18th mm-hmm. about Cynthia McKinney, who, for those who are listening and aren't familiar with her, she's a former congresswoman from Georgia.
Very former.
Yes.
Yeah, she was run out of town on a rail out of Atlanta. And actually, it was really a story about the suppression and the twisting and bending of news that you get in the mainstream press in the United States. And it's in the book, The Best Democracy, because the point of the Best Democracy Money Can Buy is to give you all those stories that are, like you say, censored.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the stories that I put in the book, but I'd also broadcast on BBC Television and put in The Guardian, and won one of those awards for, by the way, was that before September 11th, the attack, the Bush administration had killed off various investigations of terrorism and al-Qaeda, including Saudi funding of terrorist fronts. And in particular, for example, I had secret FBI agent reports requesting to investigate the American bin Laden family, which were rejected until September 13th, by which time they had flown the coup. Now, This would be very, very shocking news, except that this week, 2003, the New York Times stepped forward in its big stentorian voice said, you know, we have seen the missing pages of the official report of the September 11th attack, and they've left out the information that Saudi Arabia and the royal family and others have been funding terrorist fronts, including al-Qaeda. Now, of course, so the New York Times, by stealing an official report, was able to break this news in 2003 that the BBC broke in November of 2001, immediately after the attack. The difference being that the New York Times suppressed that story in 2001, and Cynthia McKinney, the congresswoman, on the floor of Congress, had the nerve to say someone ought to check into this report from BBC.
Right.
And for saying that and repeating that on a program on the Pacifica Network, which I was, in fact, I was discussing it with the host today of that show, for repeating the request to investigate the report I broke on BBC, she was vilified, attacked, called a traitor, a loony by the Democratic senator, her own party from Georgia, and why? Because they said She is charging President Bush with knowing in advance about the attacks of September 11th. And that is never what she said. That is not what she said. In fact, I spoke to ex-Congressman McKinney this week, who is still fuming about this, of course. She simply said that there were intelligence failures, which we ought to investigate and find out what's behind it and who's profiting from those mistakes. And for that same for that question, for which, by the way, Bob Graham, whose family owns the Washington Post, said almost her exact same words, and the Post did not vilify him. She was vilified and smeared and run from office. And it was a and the important thing there, by the way, George, is that it was a signal. Mm-hmm. Don't ask questions. Don't ask questions or we'll do this to you. And with the exception, by the way, of Bob Graham, who obviously, since his family owns the Washington Post, doesn't worry too much about the mainstream press, with the exception of Bob Graham, all politicians, after the McKinney lynching, shut their mouth. Now, she was easy to lynch, by the way, because she is a black woman.
Right.
And not only a black woman, but an uppity black woman who, you know, who stepped forward and asked a very important question about intelligence failures that led to the deaths of all these people. It didn't mean that Bush planned the killings. That's insane. She never said that. That's not what she said. But she asked to investigate intelligence failures, just as Bob Graham has now stepped forward and demanded the same thing.
Now, there is kind of a cottage industry, especially on the Internet, where people are basically have already concluded that Bush administration was involved in September 11th. What do you make of this phenomenon of conspiracism, and do you think it detracts from real, documented investigative journalism?
I think two things. One is that the reason that there's this, like you say, the cottage industry of people believing that there was a conspiracy by Bush to attack America is that we get lied to and lied to and lied to by National Public Radio, which, by the way, ran that McKinney story,
mm-hmm.
This fake story about McKinney's saying that Bush knew in advance. We get lied to by the New York Times, and, of course, it goes down from there. Then you get into, you know, Fox, you know, and, you know, USA Today or whatever, you know, like a complete, you know, McNews. And so we get such nonsense and drivel, disinformation and baloney from the U.S. government. You know, Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction. Mm-hmm. Don't forget, we were told by our president that, talk about conspiracy fruitcakes, the president of the United States said that Saddam Hussein was involved with al-Qaeda. So, you know, when you talk about people off the far edge with acting with no evidence, with complete fantasy conspiracies, no one touches the White House for this stuff, right? So you have fantasists in the White House, conspiracy fruitcakes in the White House. You have a eyes wide shut press in America. So, of course, that leaves the field open where people say, well, any old thing, you know, we don't believe anyone, so we might as well believe the worst.
I see.
And that's the problem, is that when you have a government which is committed to propaganda and a press which is completely dead on its feet and lazy and accepts it, then it leaves the field wide open for what you call conspiracy nuts are really basically people who are just speculating, and I think speculating beyond the evidence, and which people shouldn't do. But they're going to do it because they don't trust anyone else.
And that question of evidence is the line between conspiracy, armchair theorizing, and investigative journalism.
Yeah, it's the evidence, right? And the problem is, the problem I run into is that, like, I'm called a conspiracy nut all the time because, it gets a hell of a laugh from the conspirators, you know? And there are conspiracies, by the way. Before I was a journalist, I was a conspiracy expert for the United States government, doing racketeering cases. Racketeering, by the way, is defined as a conspiracy to commit fraud.
Like domestic crimes and that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, so the conspiracy. So, like, for example, you're in Connecticut, you've got lots of conspirators there. You have a power company, United Illuminating, which I worked on, and then the Shoreham Nuclear Plant. You have all these nuclear plant builders which would get together and conspire to lie about the price of a nuclear plant, or how safe it was. And I brought some of those cases for the government. And they actually, people really do sit around in rooms and figure out how to lie to you. If if people meet secretly and then figure out how to manufacture a lie, that's a conspiracy. And that's what it's all about. In fact, investigative reporting, it really is nothing but is almost totally an issue of unmasking conspiracies.
While we're on the subject of these nuclear power plants, in your book, you discuss the power plant. It was the Shoreham plant, right, in New York State?
Yeah, New York on Long Island. And so some of you listening could probably see it across the water, or what used to be the Shoreham nuclear plant. Right?
They had estimated that it would cost, I believe it was $1.8 billion to build it, while an internal memo said that it was going to be $3.5 billion.
Right, and so I got the internal memos and brought a racketeering case on behalf of the government, and then we won a multi-billion dollar judgment, and now Long Island Lighting is owned by the public.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a nice little outcome. The problem was that I couldn't get one gosh darn paper to cover that story. Even today, that's a heck of a story that the public was gypped out of billions, and yet there was not one newspaper, with the exception, by the way, the Wall Street Journal, that told about the deception, the 10 years of conspiracy and deception that was behind the building of that nuclear plant.
But now you had helped win a judgment against them, and then Governor Mario Cuomo squashed that, right?
Yeah. Oh, by the way, the former governor, he's for those of you who remember your political trivia, we had a governor in New York named Mario, and he wanted to be president, but he was quite convinced that that bankrupting, not so much bankrupting electric company would upset people, would upset the big donors, but the big banks had about $8 billion in debt lent out to this company. So he decided he was going to save this company, which is a lot of people are always surprised here. The liberal would do this. So he convinced the judge through intermediaries to overturn this verdict. And now, one thing that, because the governor is livid about my reporting this, and I'm sorry if he's livid, but I do want to make the point that, unlike some of the other creepy stories I've run into, he didn't pay off the judge or offer the judge anything. He just really reached the judge, I think, in an improper manner to convince him, you know, ex parte, as they say, phone calls through intermediaries to say, you can't bankrupt this company because they'll operate a dangerous nuclear plant in retaliation. And it was so
unlike all of the other nuclear plants.
Unlike
right?
all the other, see, okay. You'd have to. We called it the terrorist in the helicopter story. In other words, that we knew that the maniacs that ran the Long Island Lighting Company, you know, they were criminal conspirators after all. You know, they were like the terrorist in the helicopter is going to pull the pin out of the hand grenade. And, you know, if you dare try to bankrupt us, we'll operate this dangerous nuclear plant. So we worked out a deal where they closed the plant. It's been dismantled. But what's very interesting, by the way, for those of you listening in Connecticut, I have all the stuff about the kind of mushroom cloud kind of effect that would happen if there was a meltdown, which, of course, applies very well to those Connecticut plants which are still operating.
Mm-hmm.
I was laughing, but you know, if you're the guys that'll fry if there's a problem. I'm not laughing too hard. I'm actually sitting here in Long Island Sound. If the wind blows the wrong way, I'm going with you. But so what I used to do is racketeering investigations, but I decided that the U.S. media didn't know how to report the stories. They were lazy. They were, you know, it's expensive doing investigative reporting, by the way. Mm-hmm. It's not cheap stuff. And it's risky stuff. You could get sued. I've been sued by Bush's gold mining company. I bet you didn't even know that Bush had a gold mining company, right? Or most people listening didn't even know that. Well, I was sued by Bush's gold mining company. So it's expensive, it's risky, it's difficult, it's time-consuming. And in a world where the news is what happened 11 minutes ago, according to, you know, the kind of CNN effect, it's, you know, you just don't get news producers in America or news editors in America who will let you do it.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to author Greg Pallast. He's an investigative journalist with The Guardian and The Observer newspapers in Britain, and he's the author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. I'm Doug McNeil here in the studios of WHUS Radio, and with me is George King. Greg, I want to get back to one thing we were just talking about a little bit earlier, just to touch on 9/11 one more time.
Sure.
I was wondering if you had ever looked into why the military was ordered to stand down on that morning. They had an hour and a half to scramble fighters to intercept the hijacked airlines, but it wasn't done. You've got an absolutely unprecedented event of four hijacked planes in the air simultaneously, and you sit and watch. What do you make of that?
You know what? I don't know. How about that for a good one? You know what? I'm an investigative reporter, so if I have an investigator, I don't report it. I've been asked about that. And, you know, I mean, the problem is that there's a simple reason, which is, and once there's a simple reason, we don't look for the more dangerous reason, which the simple reason being that we don't shoot down civilian jetliners. We don't expect them to crash into buildings. We expect hijackers to say, you know, take
them. Well, nonetheless, you want to intercept them with a fighter.
Yeah, I mean, it's unusual. I don't know why this happened, and I've been unable, frankly, I just haven't been able to get one answer anywhere. So I don't know, and therefore, I don't, like, you know what, I don't do is draw lines from dots I can't fill in, and so I just can't tell you anywhere. I mean, all I can say is that what we do know, again, I don't have any information that you know, like mm-hmm. Bush or someone else in our government are in on it, but I certainly know this.
After reading your book, I see that you don't draw lines to dots that don't exist. I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. I just... You know, if I see two points, I draw a line between them, not an elephant, you know. But I think that what we have is really serious and disturbing enough, what we do know. And you know, and I'm glad that the New York Times, 2 years after the fact and after our reports in The Guardian and BBC did it, is finally saying, gee, looks like there's evidence that the Saudis were behind the funding of these groups. And I guess so now that the New York Times has joined my conspiracy pact, right, my conspiracy nut crowd. But that's the information we keep getting, and that the terrible thing is that we were not investigating the Saudi money links. And here's the latest thing I found, by the way, is if you read the book, you will know that there was a meeting in June of 1996 between Saudi royals, various arms dealers, Saudi billionaires, and the financial arm of Al-Qaeda, in which the Saudis agreed to give money to Al-Qaeda's fronts, like charity fronts and others, so that they would not, because they liked Al-Qaeda, by the way, which is trying to overthrow the Saudi royal family.
Right.
The reason they were giving them money was a protection racket number. You know, it's like Osama bin Laden, by the way, is a lot like John Gotti. Pay me money or I'll blow up your yachts. So they paid him a bunch of money to go play in Uzbekistan and Afghanistan and Kyrgyzstan. But he used that money, part of it apparently, for, and Khalid Muhammad, who is his logistics chief, used the money in part to get flying lessons for people in America who had no intention of landing. And this is the problem, because our intelligence agencies left it to the French and others to investigate this. Our guys were kind of a bit standoffish. This is even under the Clinton administration. They're a bit standoffish about following this, hunting this stuff down. And the Bush administration, when it came in, went from standoffish to turn your back on it. And what I mean by that is Bill Clinton sent two delegations, and this you won't read in the New York Times, by the way. Bill Clinton sent two delegations to Saudi Arabia in the year 2000 saying, listen, you got a lot of Saudis. It may go back to royal family here, who are giving money to Al-Qaeda and their maniacs. Knock it off. They're killing us. Don't do it. Now, this is very polite, because you always speak politely to the guys who are sitting on top of your oil spigots. Two delegations from Clinton. Bush comes in. Of course, it had no effect on the Saudis, as far as I could see.
Hmm.
Bush comes in. No more delegations. There are not only no more delegations, so the Saudis don't feel disturbed in their ways. He actually knocks out... Bush disbands the intelligence group, which is hunting down these financial connections. Now, it's not, again, because I have information that Bush wanted us to be attacked, but it was clear that Bush did not want to release or uncover information, which is very embarrassing not only to the United States government, but to his family personally, because the people under investigation were his family's financial backers.
Greg, the real meat of your book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, regards the fraud in the 2000 U.S. presidential election.
Yeah, that's the first of the nine chapters, yeah.
In the 5 minutes or so that we have left, could you go over that, give our listeners a thumbnail sketch of some of the important highlights of the fraud and the wrongs that were perpetrated in that election.
Well, Doug, I would, but don't you think it's time to move on? Don't you want to just get
listen,
over it
Catherine.
Already, Doug? Come on.
Listen,
okay.
Catherine.
All right, well, you got me. Okay, so we won't spend a long time on it because it's just time to move on. The first chapter of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy is called Jim Crow in Cyberspace. What I discovered for BBC Television and The Guardian is that 5 months before the election, Catherine Harris and Jeb Bush ordered the removal of 57,700 voters from the voter rolls. As it turns out, now why'd they do this? They said these people were felons. Our record shows these people are criminals, not allowed to vote in Florida. Guess what? I get a hold of the actual list out of Harris's computer. I look at the list. They don't look like those felons to me. They look like people with names similar to felons somewhere in the United States. Turns out 97% of these people, 97% are absolutely innocent of any crime, except in over half the cases, they are guilty of being black. Now, I'm not guessing that these are mostly black voters, because in Florida, right next to the voter name on the voter registry is the voter's race, and I counted them up. I literally took the computer stuff, had some experts throw it into a spreadsheet for me. We counted the names of the innocents. We counted the names of the black people, and thousands of Democrats, basically, were knocked off the voter rolls before the election. My latest count is looking at Al Gore net. Not everyone votes. Not everyone votes Democratic. But looking at the demographics, the experts were putting minimum 30,000 votes lost to Al Gore. That's an absolute stone cold minimum. 30,000 votes in an election called by 500 votes by Catherine Harris. So I mean. And they're not done, because the end of that chapter is all about the theft of the election 2004. Right. That's what they're doing. There's a new bill that was passed and signed by our president called the Help America Vote Act, Doug.
How
and,
cynical.
And I don't know about you, but as soon as George Bush tells me he's going to help me vote, I get a little bit nervous. So if those who want to know about, obviously read the book, because it's until Patriot Act 6, you can still read books. So read The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. I do want you to read it. Take it out of the library. You don't have to make me.
And I want to tell our listeners.
Make my agents richer by buying the book. Get it out of the library. But what you can do is go to my website, www.gregpalace.com, and sign the petition, which I wrote with Martin Luther King III, to stop the theft of the election 2004.
And I want to tell our listeners, too, that this is not a dry read. Greg has a great style. He breaks the book up into bite-sized chunks, despite the fact there's a hell of a lot of information in it. And he peppers it up with just enough salty language to keep you interested.
Well, you know, in Britain, they call it loo reading.
Is that it?
Because what it is, it's one of those books you kind of...
They also call you a sleaze reporter too.
The book in the private area, because it's these nice little bits where first you read about the election, then you read about the Bush and the Bin Ladens, and you can read about Pat Robertson. There's a nice little chapter on him. And little bits, get all that news you're not allowed to get in America, all that censored stuff. Well, actually, you know, it's very interesting. So I was called The Liar by Tony Blair, a very famous case that I did. I won the equivalent of the Pulitzer Prize in Britain for uncovering Blair's first big set of lies before his more recent ones. And so then Blair called me a liar. And it was very funny. So they say, you know, they call me sleaze reporter because I'm reporting on the sleaze of the government. So it's a very cute adjective that the Mirror newspaper used on me. So I've been vilified in Britain by the Prime Minister's favorite guys. And Catherine Harris, I do want to warn you, by the way, Catherine Harris calls me twisted and maniacal.
Well, congratulations on that.
And, you know, I didn't say she's wrong, but she's never said that I'm inaccurate in these reports. So, you know, you're right. You know, it's grim stuff, but you can have a bit of fun with it, because if you don't, you know, it's like, you know, like my colleague Mike Moore actually showed me, you know, who actually writes a lot of his stuff based on my team's investigation. And he really showed me how that, you know, you could take the grimmest stuff and you gotta have a couple laughs out of it, because otherwise you'd be crying all the time.
Now, moving on to the future, as Ms. Harris might want us to do, are there any clues that you think the public should watch out for that might point to more fraud before, during, or shortly after the next election day?
Well, if you see the president and he's moving his lips, there's fraud. But all kidding aside, there really is. I am very concerned about this Help America Vote Act, which is computerizing, going to force the computerization of voting across America. In particular, while the public is now a little bit nervous about the computerization, those touchscreen ballots when you walk into the voting booth, the computerization that you don't see, which is computerizing the central voter file of each state, and that's required by the new law before the next election, required. What they're going to do is computerize all the voter rolls and allow every Secretary of State, that means 50 Catherine Harris's, to scrub those rolls of people they consider possibly ineligible. Now, that's what happened in Florida, so they're repeating the Florida system nationwide. That's what you got to watch out for. So there's a lot of organizations out there right now who are fighting this like crazy, and especially, like I say, Martin Luther King III and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, Working Assets, we're running a campaign, and that's why I tell people go to my website, because you can actually kind of sign on electronically, and I promise you we won't change your vote. You know what I mean? Or you can print it out and do your paper ballot. You can print it out and get a petition signed that says we do not. We want you to reverse this Help America Vote Act. We don't need your help. No thanks.
And that website is?
That website has a very original name. It's gregpalast.com. That's triple dub, GREGPALAST.com.
Very good.
Named after my mother's favorite son.
And to sum up our interview tonight, in the last chapter of your book, this is quoting from your book, "I've got a stack of letters that read, 'Your book is depressing.' True, but only if you put your hands in your pockets, look at your shoes, and whistle." What do you say to our listeners right now, Greg? What can they do if they're outraged by what we've been talking about? What can they do to change things?
Well, first of all, they've already begun. They're listening to something other than, than Fox droppings.
Okay, well, that's good. They've listened. Now, what can they do once they get up off the couch?
Yeah, but that's really important. So first, get the news from real places. Get on the net to places like BBC, et cetera. But then there's things you can do. In fact, at the back of the book, there's a whole listing of I just gave you one thing. Sign the petition. Okay, you might think that that's small, but that's the beginning. And then there are many organizations that are very active that you can support, that you can get info from, that you can participate in. Everything, for example, from People for the American Way to People United for Separation of Church and State. You wonder what that is. This is a group that kind of tracks what the Reverend Pat Robertson's up to. And believe me, he's going to have a lot to do with. He has a lot to do with who the current president is. He'll have a lot to do with who the next one is. And you can kind of be deputized to do something. And the other thing you can do is that at the back of my book, there's a coupon which you can fill out. If you ever run across a document, if you're working for government or for business, and you think that there's something confidential or secret hidden in those files that might best be made public, please let me know about it. I'm an investigative reporter, and I love to get the material from inside those file cabinets. Send it to me. Don't waste it. So, you're all deputized now. You're all junior. What was his name? Jimmy? Who is Clark Kent's assistant?
Jimmy Olsen? Blaine
or something?
Jimmy Olsen.
Okay, so you're all Jimmy Olsons. And send Clark Kent, Greg Palast,
I'm so honored,
by email or by snail mail, a note with the goodies. And we'll get that stuff out. And especially those guys listening who are over at United Illuminating, who dropped a bunch of documents on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. The new Nuclear Regulatory Commission doesn't regulate anymore. They're just Nuclear Commission. And so you got to send the stuff to me.
I've got one last question, a quick one for you. Will we hear more political reporting from you during the next Democratic administration?
No one gets a free pass. I have a file cabinet on Hillary Clinton that would burn... that would burn a hole straight through Connecticut. And in fact, you'll see some hints of it in the book. I am a bipartisan pain in the boot because that's what investigative reporters do. The reason I'm considered anti-Bush is that he's the guy in power. Mm-hmm. What am I supposed to do, beat up the guys who aren't in power? What's the fun of that? You know, like go up and do an expose on the Boy Scouts? I mean, it just doesn't really matter. You know, the Democratic Party is nearly comatose. You know, what should I just do, unplug the respirator? I mean, there's just no point in spending a lot of time investigating the guys on the out.
Greg,
but if they start getting coming back in, no one is safe.
I see.
Greg, I'm sorry that's all the time we've had. That's the fastest half hour I've ever spent. We've been talking to sleaze reporter and investigative journalist Greg Pallast, investigative journalist with The Guardian and the Observer newspapers in Britain, and the author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. It's been on the New York Times bestseller list for 5 months. Greg, thanks ever so much for taking time and talking to us, and I hope we can talk again sometime.
Doug, George, you're the best. Thanks. Bye.
Thank you, Greg. Bye. The preceding program was recorded in the studios of WHUS Radio. For WHUS, I'm Doug McNeil.
And I'm George King.
Thank you for listening.